From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. China has devalued its national currency, the yuan, to its lowest rate against the U.S. dollar in almost 3 years. The People's Bank of China says the move was a one-off depreciation to make the exchange rate more market-orientated. But it brought about fresh concerns for many economies, including Australia's resource sector. Economists and miners say it has the potential to further damage an already shrinking mining industry. David Taylor reports.
The annual Diggers and Dealers Conference in Kalgoorlie is a chance for miners big and small to get together and make deals. Bill Beeman is the managing director of gold producer Northern Star. He attended this year's conference, but he says many of the industry's junior players didn't show up.
Oh, look, I don't even think there was a junior iron ore stock at Diggers and Dealers, so that tells you that, I guess, their attitude and the sentiment towards that part of the industry.
He says the junior miners, once awash with cash, are finding it difficult to raise any money now.
It is difficult down there. You know, they're definitely capital starved. Investors don't want to put their hand in their pocket for small companies. Very difficult, that bottom end.
Bill Beeman says the economic slowdown in the world's second largest economy is in fact being felt across all miners.
The negative sentiment in China is what's flowing through to the base metals and the iron ores and bulk.
It follows a string of weak economic data from China. Last weekend, the country revealed its exports fell by 8.3% in July, far worse than expected. Francis Lun is the CEO of Hong Kong brokerage firm GeoSecurities.
Chinese exports have become very expensive. China's manufacturing cost is only marginally lower than in the US. So this actually makes China's exports uncompetitive.
Economists say China's policymakers are running out of options to stimulate the economy, except maybe for one. Michael Metcalf is the head of macro strategy at State Street. He spoke to Bloomberg.
By our estimates, so like a PPP estimate, for instance, the renminbi was 10% overvalued.
Mr. Metcalf says by dropping the value of China's currency, the renminbi, exporters should receive some immediate relief and the economy a boost. Australian economists, though, aren't as sanguine.
It just underscores the fact that the Chinese economy is slowing.
Saul Leslake says it's a zero-sum game. As Chinese exporters benefit from the lower currency, Australian companies lose out. He says lower international commodities prices simply rub salt into the wound.
Overall, resources exporters are probably worse off today with commodity prices being where they are and the currency at 70 cents than they were 3 or 4 years ago when commodity prices were a lot higher, as well as the Australian dollar being higher.
State Street's Michael Metcalf again.
And it's interesting that the reaction that we've seen so far has been to hit commodity-linked assets, hit commodity prices. But this is an easing by China, which in general should be supportive of those assets in the medium term.
Economists and mining managers are now waiting to see if China will once again push down its currency, or if this really was just a one-off move.
David Taylor reporting. The Coalition Party room in Australia took around 6 hours this week to decide against giving MPs and senators a consensus vote on same-sex marriage. Two-thirds of Liberal and National MPs decided against changing the Coalition's policy that marriage is between a man and a woman. The Prime Minister said that he will look at this and possibly offer it in a referendum in the next poll. And while Tony Abbott has been backing a strong majority of the Coalition, half of his front benchers split with him and argued in favor of a consensus vote. Our political correspondent Louisa Yaxley has the story.
Half the front bench split with the Prime Minister's position and argued for a conscience vote, including Christopher Pyne, Malcolm Turnbull, George Brandis, Greg Hunt and Josh Frydenberg. Mr. Abbott says backbenchers can still exercise their right to cross the floor if the bill is voted on.
But front benchers would not be so free.
South Australian Corey Bernardi has a warning for front benchers.
They don't want to support that policy. They're free to do so, but there are consequences. Namely, they must resign their executive positions.
Malcolm Turnbull supports gay marriage and a conscience vote and told the party room the Coalition is trailing badly in the opinion polls and questioned if anyone was seriously saying that having ministers resign would be good for the government. Backbencher Ewan Jones was one of that third of the party room to call for a free vote.
Any disappointment I might have in relation to being a Liberal and the issue over a conscience vote was more than overridden by the fair go that everyone had in that room. My biggest fear on the whole issue now, if we put it to a vote and it gets belted, where do we go?
Other Liberals told the party room that this issue won't go away. Senator Bernardi argues Parliament's dealt with it enough times.
It just seems that some people don't want to take no for an answer.
Greens Senator Janet Rice says her party's going to be persisting.
We are going to pursue having a vote in the Senate, and we will be suggesting to Liberal Party members who are unhappy with the outcome of their party room meeting today that they should be crossing the floor.
As he left after the lengthy meeting last night, LNP backbencher Andrew Lamming wasn't ruling out crossing the floor.
I've made it very clear I'll only vote the way my electorate votes. At the moment, that process is happening.
And if they say they're in favour, will you vote in favour of marriage equality?
I'll answer that question for you tomorrow when I release those results.
Mr Abbott and many in the coalition are now backing a national vote on the issue. Senator Rice from the Greens dismisses the idea.
It's a delay tactic. We don't need a referendum, we don't need a plebiscite.
Labor backbencher Pat Conroy scoffed at the plebiscite idea.
Would be a very expensive opinion poll.
The Liberal who's doggedly pursued this issue, Warren Entsch, has issued a statement saying he's disappointed but not angry. He says his bill will be introduced on Monday and he'll highlight some of the heartfelt stories that have led him to push for the law to be changed. He concedes that the party room result means if it came to a vote, it would fail. The coalition party room result was comprehensive, but it hasn't ended the issue. There are more decisions pending on what policy to take to the next election, and more immediately, how the government operates after half its most senior ranks were on the losing side of a debate about a conscience vote, an issue that many consider fundamental to the nature of the Liberal Party.
Well, as we just heard, the party conference room went actually on for quite some time. Now, to find out a little bit more about this, Michael Bresenton spoke to the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott earlier this week.
You called this coalition party room meeting yesterday to discuss this, not just a Liberal party room meeting, and that was described as tantamount to a branch stack by Christopher Pyne. Was it designed to ensure the anti-camp won?
No, Michael, it was designed to exactly reflect what I said before the election. As you know, this matter has been around for some years. From 2004 onwards, our position was clearly that marriage was between a man and a woman. When asked about our position at the last election, I said that if this matter came up, it would be a matter for the coalition party room to deal with in the usual way. And so when it did come up yesterday, when Warren Entsch did put on the table in the Liberal Party room his determination to be one of the co-sponsors of a private member's bill, I thought, well, let's get it discussed in the coalition party room as I'd promised before the election.
I think some of your Liberal colleagues were hoping it was going to be discussed in the usual way in the Liberal Party room, though, weren't they? That is clear.
But, look, there's absolutely no doubt. Some of my colleagues would have preferred that it was a Liberal Party room discussion, but the clear commitment that I gave pre-election was that it would be discussed in the coalition party room in the usual way, and I thought it was very important that we should honour our pre-election commitment. And one of the points that was made again and again by party room speakers yesterday was that their electorates had heard them say pre-election that they supported the fact that marriage is between a man and a woman, and our party supported the fact that marriage was between a man and a woman.
So a six-hour meeting, at least 30 people, as we understand, spoke in favour of a free vote.
It was about 60-30, yeah.
Clearly a considerable number of those were from your own party. Mm-hmm. Half your own front bench support the idea, and now you've offered them the prospect of a plebiscite or a referendum sometime in the year after the next election. Now, won't that just delay the resolution of this for another couple of years? Because to some it does look a little tricky.
Well, Michael, I accept that there is some disappointment, but we have got to do what we can to keep faith with the public. And before the election, I said that this would be considered by the coalition party room in the usual way. We had a very long debate. More than 90 members of the party room, including About 30 front benches spoke yesterday. No one constrained anyone. It was a very free-flowing debate. It was the kind of discussion that, frankly, makes me proud of all my colleagues. And the decision was, for this term of Parliament, to maintain our position, but to consider in the run-up to the election what our position would be in the next term of Parliament. And the pretty clear disposition in the party room was to put it to the people in the next term of Parliament. And what can be wrong with that? So we have supported the traditional position. I think that's a good thing. We've kept faith with the electorate. I think that's a good thing. But there is the prospect of change in the next term of Parliament if that is the will of the Australian people.
I guess, we're talking about the keeping faith with the Australian people. Mm-hmm. Clearly the polling shows that the majority of Australian people now are well and truly in favour of this idea. Even Crosby mm-hmm. Texter, your own, close to the Liberal Party, it has to be said, their polling shows 72% support for this. You don't need a plebiscite to answer the question.
Nevertheless, this is an important subject. It is a very personal subject. It's a subject on which many people have very deep feelings. And I think the best way of resolving this, if we are to change, I say if we are to change, given that same-sex marriage is something which has only very recently come into our intellectual and cultural parameters, given that it's really only this generation that has ever thought of this, why not give it to the people, given the fact that this is a very personal, very deeply held, quite contentious matter.
You hold very strong views about this. Did you ever think this would be one of the defining issues of your prime ministership?
Well, look, I certainly didn't imagine when I woke up yesterday morning that we would have a six-hour party room meeting on this subject later in the day. I knew that Warren may well raise this in the party room, but I had no idea how it was going to pan out. But as I said, it was a very good debate. I think everyone participated in a very good spirit, and as speaker after speaker said towards the end, this is something that we can be proud of.
Your own sister, Christine Foster, mm-hmm. who is gay, as we all know, was on Late Line last night expressing her disappointment. Mm-hmm. She believes the issue should be left to the conscience of our elected representatives. I mean, what do you say to liberals like her who say that it's a core liberal principle that we're all equal before the law?
Yet it has been our clear policy for more than a decade that marriage was between a man and a woman. And frankly, prior to that, it would never have occurred to anyone in our culture and civilization that marriage was not between a man and a woman. I can remember my own university debates with gay friends, and the idea that the gay community would in those days have wanted to embrace a bourgeois institution like marriage would have been unthinkable. But things change.
But after the Irish referendum, mm-hmm. you rejected the idea of a national vote, didn't you? You said that the questions of marriage are the preserve of the Commonwealth mm-hmm. Parliament.
No,
What's changed your mind?
I did say that, and certainly that was my instinct at that moment. But obviously, the party room has been thinking about this. A lot of people have been discussing it, and quite a number of speakers, an increasing number of speakers, as the debate wore on last night, said that while we should preserve our existing position for this term of Parliament, it did need something more to be done in the future, and the best way to resolve this was by putting it to the people.
Will you allow the Warren Inch bill to go to a vote?
Well, look, let's see where things go. We don't actually know what the bill provides at this point.
I think we can have a pretty good guess at what it's
going to
be.
Yes, but a point that was made by many speakers yesterday, including people who wanted a free vote, including people who, in principle, support same-sex marriage, said, we've got to see the bill first. So let's see the bill. Let's let the dust settle from yesterday's discussion. As I said, if it does come before the Parliament, obviously our backbenchers are entitled to vote in the end, whichever way they want. I'd be disappointed if they went against the party position, but nevertheless, we've always accepted that in the end, all votes in our party room for backbenchers at least, are conscience
and
votes.
If it does come to a vote, frontbenchers, if they vote by their conscience, will have to resign. That's a prospect that, as Malcolm Turnbull said, wouldn't be a good look for the government if that happened, would it?
But it is, nevertheless, the standard position of our party that if a frontbencher cannot support the party's policy, that person has to leave the front bench. That's always been our position. But precisely because I think there is a general acceptance that this is a very personal issue, we will not be attempting to bind anyone beyond the life of this parliament.
Inevitably, this has been cast as another test of your leadership. Mm-hmm. It's created further division. That's certainly clear. Or it's entrenched some of the divisions. Mm-hmm. Half of your front bench, as we know, have wanted a free vote. But what do you say to those sorts of suggestions that that this is another test?
This is a difficult issue, obviously. And every time a party leader has to handle a difficult issue, some people say, well, it should have been done this way, it should have been done that way. If someone else was the leader, this might have happened or that might have happened. But look, I am the leader. I had to make a call, and I think this is the best call, given the very long and full debate we had yesterday.
And 6 months ago, you declared the start of good government.
I think I declared the restart of good government, but certainly what I wanted to do the day after the day of that motion being dealt with was to get back to the fundamentals. And for this government, the fundamentals are jobs, growth and community safety. And that's what people expect us to be focused on, and that's what we will be focused on every day as far as I'm concerned.
Is this what good government looks like, this sort of chaotic decision-making process that seems to be dividing your front bench?
But Michael, this is a difficult issue. No one would deny that this is a difficult issue, but I think what we did yesterday was entirely in keeping with our pre-election commitment. It was a very respectful process, a very, very respectful process, and what I think has come out of it is a good way forward. We will keep faith with the electorate. We will maintain our existing position for the life of this parliament, but our disposition going into the next election, should we win the next election, will be to put it to the people in the next term of parliament. So we have kept faith with the traditional position while at the same time offering a way forward, a decent and a good and a properly democratic way forward for those who would like to see change.
Let's move on to broader issues now, because 6 months ago you were in trouble. The polls haven't shifted. In fact, if anything, they've gone slightly backwards. Things don't really seem to be improving, do they, for your government?
Well, as you know, Michael, I don't offer a running commentary on polls.
Sure, but that's a reality, isn't it?
Look, I'm not going to deny it, but I know that polls do go up and down.
The problem is they haven't gone up for 15 months.
I am confident that this government is doing exactly what we were elected to do. We've got rid of the carbon tax, we've stopped the boats, we're getting the budget back under control, we're building the roads of the future. This government is keeping faith with the people, and every day we are focused on jobs, growth and community safety. Sure, there's a lot of political static. That's the nature of this business. The intensity of politics seems to be increasing all the time. Nevertheless, if you want stability, competence and political integrity, I think you can stick with this government.
All right, let's move to some of the policy areas. Mm-hmm. Climate change in particular, obviously a big one this week. The Paris targets that you've announced, mm-hmm. 26 to 28% mm-hmm. perhaps by 2030. That's hardly pulling our weight internationally on this issue, is it? When you look at, compare us to the US, which has the same target 5 years earlier, 2025, Canada 30% by 2030, Europe 40% by then.
34% on 2005 figures. So if we compare apples with apples, we are doing about as well as the United States, a touch below Canada and New Zealand.
Well, except the US is well
ahead of Japan. And, of course, Korea is just promising a 4% reduction, and China is committed to a 150% increase. So, look, the other point to make is that when you look at emissions per person, we've got a 50% reduction, which is the best outcome of any of the developed countries which have so far pledged a target for Paris. So this is a very respectable figure. It's environmentally responsible, and above all else, it's economically responsible. We are confident we can achieve this without clobbering jobs and growth, because in the end, that's what we want. We want more jobs and we want higher economic growth, because that means more prosperity.
Even that 20%, 26% target, though, will cost some jobs, won't it? Some old coal mining coal mines will have to close, some inefficient industries will have to close.
We are not expecting a reduction in the coal industry. Obviously, in the ordinary course of events, some mines will close, but I suspect more mines will open. And the great thing about the Australian coal industry is that it's actually helping countries like China to reduce their emissions intensity, if not their overall emissions, because our coal is better quality coal than the Chinese and Indian coal.
How do you square this? The figure that the Climate Change Authority and others mm-hmm. have said that to keep warming to within 2 degrees, a cut of between 40 and 60% mm. is required. Now, you say you're committed to that goal to keep warming within 2 degrees, but 26% isn't anywhere near that figure.
Well, it's very, very similar, highly comparable to what other countries have committed to, they're all bigger emitters than us.
But it's half what experts say is required.
Well, this is an issue for President Obama. This is an issue for
leadership for everyone.
For President Hollande. Look, what we are doing on a per capita basis, on a per person basis, is the best in the developed world. And what we are doing on an absolute basis, we're not leading the field, but we're certainly not lagging the field either. And we're doing it without a carbon tax, without an emissions trading scheme or an electricity tax scam, as I call it. We're not going to clobber the economy. Yes, there are some costs, but they're manageable. If we adopt Labor's plan for a 50% renewable target, there's an $85 billion overbuild of generating capacity. There's a $200 a tonne carbon tax.
Well, let's talk about renewables. You've made it pretty clear you're no friend of renewables. You've directed the Clean Energy Finance Corporation to cease investment in wind farms and domestic-scale solar. You've publicly derided wind farms. But aren't these the jobs of the future? I mean, you'll need them. Reach those targets, even your 26% target.
Well, Michael, they are highly subsidised jobs. Without the subsidy, we wouldn't have renewables on anything like the scale that we do. Now, I certainly think there's a place for renewables, and I support the legislation which went through the Parliament that settled this matter. The renewable target is now 23%, so it's gone up a little. And to meet that target, there's going to have to be a very substantial build of renewable capacity over the next 5 years.
Okay, just quickly and very quickly on entitlements. Bronwyn Bishop is the only one to have lost a job, but does it set a precedent?
I think the important thing is to have a better system. Plainly, the system is not meeting community expectations, and I don't want a system where some things are within the rules but without community support. So we will have a better system. I think it will be a system that the public can have more confidence in, but it will be independent, it will be accountable, it will be transparent, it will be workable, and ultimately it will be fair.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Prime Minister Tony Abbott, thanks very much for joining us.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. This week, the world marked the 70th anniversary of the day the first atomic bomb was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. There's also another cause for a somber reflection, with the accompanying anniversary being observed for the second atomic bomb attack that followed just days later on the city of Nagasaki. The 70,000 victims of the attack there were being remembered in ceremonies. The anniversaries have revived debate whether the atomic bomb attack should be remembered as war crimes, but Japan itself also committed war crimes during World War II, and few brave Japanese are struggling to get their country to remember them as an aggressor as well as a victim. Our North Asia correspondent Matthew Carney now reports from the secret island where Japan's army made its chemical weapons.
On Okunoshima Island, just off the coast of Hiroshima, Japanese families play on the beach and enjoy nature. It's the ideal summer vacation spot, but the island has a dark past. It was where Japan made its chemical weapons during World War II. and its existence was so secret that it did not appear on official maps for a decade. The Japanese government would like its past to remain hidden, but Masayuki Yamauchi is determined to expose it.
It was a war crime. Japan signed international treaties saying it wouldn't use poison gas, but it did secretly on battlefields of Asia, and it damaged many people. We have to reflect on this.
Production started in 1929, and in total, 6,000 tons of mustard gas, Lewisite gas, sneezing and tear gas was made here. A large hotel and spa resort now sits on the site. After Japan's surrender, American and Australian troops supervised the decommissioning process in 1946. They buried much of the gas in 11 undisclosed locations. Yamauchi says the Japanese government still refuses to clean it up.
The Japanese politicians are not facing up to the past. They are not looking at facts of Japan as an aggressor, and that's why they won't dispose of the gas properly.
Yamauchi shows me a massive storage site in the jungle. It's now overgrown and the original tanks have been removed. The gas was used against Chinese soldiers and civilians, and it probably would have caused horrible deaths, blistering bodies and respiratory failure.
According to the research done after World War II, Japan used poison gas in more than 2,000 cases in China, killing and injuring more than 90,000 Chinese.
The clean-up and destruction of the gas by Allied troops in 1946 was rudimentary and rushed. Much of the gas was put in barrels and, along with 1,600 shells, was loaded onto two decommissioned American landing ships. One ship was sent 60 kilometres and the other 120 kilometres into the Pacific Ocean, and there they were sunk full of poison gas. And to this day, they remain toxic time bombs at the bottom of the ocean. Records show the Australian troops wanted to dispose of the gases properly by burning it. The Americans said it would take too long and cost too much. But there was also Japanese victims, and Yasuma Fujimoto is one of the few survivors from Okunoshima Island. At 15, he got a job there making poison gas. It was good pay, and he was offered an education. 6,700 Japanese worked at the island. Fujimoto says the first priority was always to meet production targets. Safety was secondary.
So we did not wear full protection gear. We just wore cotton masks, and we inhaled arsenic trioxide till our masks became pink. Just half a gram is a lethal dose.
Most of the workers developed severe respiratory problems, and rates of cancer are 3 to 4 times greater than average. Fujimoto had to get his stomach cut out because of the cancer.
And with that report from Matthew Carney, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pelham, wishing you well, saying so long, and take care.